Hey, Larry.
Hi, what's happening?
Oh, this is attempt number two at recording this. I zigged where I should have zagged, and so here we are 2 days later, 3 days later, recording again.
So, well, hopefully we can do a better one this time.
I hope so. I hope so. The new and improved version that nobody else heard, other than me and just half of it. So on tonight's topic, we will be talking about if residency or work or presence restrictions do anything to help public safety. Do you have anything you'd like to address before we get going into it?
Well, if that's the only topic for the show tonight, I can give you an answer. No, they don't. So
All right then. Excellent.
so we don't have to do this recording then.
Excellent. So we're done, and thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you in a week. But otherwise, if you guys are finding us from the NARSAL website, I am very much appreciative to NARSAL for advertising this, and welcome. But on the registrymatters.co website, there is an email notification system that if you sign up for it, that you'll get notified when the new episode gets released. But even better, if you would subscribe using your podcast app of choice, that could be iTunes, Podcast Addict. There's a whole list of them. Or lastly, I have an announcement that we are on TuneIn, which means that you can get your Alexa to listen to the program. So all you have to do is say, "Alexa, play Registry Matters on TuneIn," and it will start playing it out of your little speaker. That's pretty darn cool, I think. And then moving on, we have some news items to cover. This one comes from the Post-Gazette. Legislature passes bill addressing legal concerns about Pennsylvania sex offender registration law. A bill meant to bring Pennsylvania's unconstitutional sex offender registration rules into compliance with state and federal law unanimously passed the state legislature on Tuesday and is expected to be signed by the governor soon. But critics of sex offender registration laws believe that what the legislature has done will further complicate the issue, likely forcing future court challenges. So this is about what we had the phone call about last week with the NARSAL conference call.
It was indeed.
And do you have anything to address about how they have rewritten the law?
Well, it was an attempt to do as little as possible to provide relief, but enough to pass constitutional muster because the gradual enhancements that had been made through the years, in particular those in 2012, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had concerns about changes that were made before then. They had two versions of Megan's Law before they passed what they refer to as SORNA now. So the legislature is trying to do no more than they have to do to find something that's constitutional. And the problem for the advocate side is that since there's a presumption of constitutionality, that this bill that's on the governor's desk, which will likely be signed, even if it went beyond what would still be constitutional and is inflicting punishment, which is what the court said that their 2012 version does, then they have to start all over again litigating because they have to overcome that presumption once again. So we're back to square one if the governor signs this bill, and my prediction is that more likely than not that the bill would be signed.
And why do you think that the governor will sign it?
Well, it passed unanimously, so the way the process works is when, and unless an executive has a vested interest in a piece of legislation and has expressed alarm about a particular aspect of a bill, if it passes unanimously, and the executive hasn't communicated anything to the legislature about any concerns that they've ignored, the chances are it would be signed. So what the advocates would be asking at this late stage would be, they would be asking the governor, in this case of Pennsylvania, to jump in here, where as far as I know, the governor was not really involved. His office didn't express any opinion one way or the other. They'd be asking the governor to veto something that passed unanimously, which would invite an override. And if it passed unanimously, unless a lot of people change their mind, they would be able to get to the override threshold fairly easily. So it would be an exercise in futility, but it could happen. The governor technically possesses that power. but I'm not expecting that the governor will exercise it in this particular case, because this is a question of public safety as far as the general public is concerned, and all the media attention is that thousands of people will soon disappear from the registry if this fix isn't implemented.
And we all know that if we can't find them, then they're just going to run around and do all kinds of nefarious things to the public.
That is unfortunately the argument that's made by those who believe that the registry should continue. The law enforcement side to some degree, and then particularly the victims, even more than the law enforcement side, but there's the pressure to do something. And then when you combine that with the media sensationalization of this, I will assure you that the phone calls coming into legislators and to the governor's office are not saying, "Governor, please veto this." The overwhelming majority of the phone calls, if there are any at this stage, are coming in saying, "Governor, sign this, the sooner the better."
This one comes from the Seattle Times. This is a change in law that criminalizes teen sexting. Teenagers should not be labeled a sex offender simply for texting intimate pictures of themselves to someone else. But that is exactly what can happen right now in Washington state. The state's child pornography laws make no distinction between teens who send pictures of their own bodies and adults who take explicit images of children to exploit them. So I guess this is kind of like the thing we covered from Mississippi a week or so ago, where here, the law, they're trying to change the law so that it doesn't criminalize teen sexting. Actually, I'm sorry, the way that reads, this law changes so that it criminalizes teen sexting. So in Seattle, you would be a criminal for taking a picture of your junk and sending it to your girlfriend.
Well, when I read the Times story myself, I read it differently, but it's been a week or so since I first looked at it. But I believe that this was attempting to make it so that that couldn't happen. So let me take a.
This is an editorial
that criminalizes teens.
Yeah, I think we covered it last week, saying that it was trying to change it. However, it's an editorial with someone on the Seattle Times editorial board saying that it should not be illegal for teens to do this, but it currently is.
It is currently, but this Senate Bill 6566 would ensure that teens who send explicit messages themselves online or by text are not treated the same as adults who distribute child pornography. So this change is a positive, not a negative, the way I'm reading this.
Okay.
So they're trying to cut out what's happening right now. And in my state, we're kind of an anomaly, because we've already done this, exactly what Mississippi and what Washington is apparently considering now. Throughout the ages, young people have shown their body parts to their peers.
Right.
If you show me mine, I'll show you yours.
Yep.
But up until recently, they had to actually be physically close to one another to make the display. And now they're doing the same thing, and have been for a number of years now, sending them through texting on their phone, now that every teenager has a phone. So they're doing what we did and didn't think anything of, but now it's against the law, because the laws that were written many years ago, before the advent of sending photos by your telephone, were designed for distributing hard copy pictures. I mean, when's the last time you've seen anybody actually make a picture and take it down to the Walgreens and have it developed and hand that out? I mean, that's what's the type of dissemination that they were trying to prevent. And so the technology has evolved, but the statutory schemes have not. So now we've got the potential, and actually the reality, of prosecuted for sending pictures of themselves, their peers. So it's a positive, as far as I'm concerned, to see Washington join the club of states that we joined. I think we're the pioneer of exempting kids from prosecution in my state.
And what is to prevent somebody from acquiring those pictures and then actually transmitting them actually as child porn?
There would be nothing, except they would be subject to prosecution, because they wouldn't have the exemption if it was an adult transmitting it. So they would be nothing that would prevent that. In fact, maybe it was you, maybe it was someone else that told me about a principal who was collecting cell phones that had photos on them, and that was the way he got busted for child porn. He was distributing what he collected from the teen phones.
That is definitely what I told you. Yeah, it'll probably be an article covered in next week's podcast.
So yes, that's quite. Well, at least he figured out how to maximize his position with his job.
Certainly. Probably making a couple extra bucks doing so. And then my understanding, most states that have the laws, the punishment is a significant numbers of years per image.
It can be very harsh, and that's another thing that we didn't buy into here. The law enforcement, in particular, our attorney general, is pushing for us to revamp our state statute regarding the way we determine the number of images, because our Supreme Court had ruled that since there was no delineation in our statutory scheme about where one count ended and where the next count began, they said that they all merged into one count. So that was a 4-3 felony. So you could have a significant amount, and under state law, you'd be subject to an 18-month period of incarceration. So we were forced to change that, and we ended up with a significant longer period of incarceration. But it's nowhere near what you can have imposed in states where they stack count after count. I think it's 9 or 10 years that you can get maximum here now with that, and that's too much. But it's not as bad as it could be if you were in Mississippi.
I don't remember where the person was. I want to say they said they were in Arizona and they said they get 10 per image. I could be wrong.
I think
And
that Arizona is really harsh. Arizona is really harsh. I've worked on a case out of Arizona where the person had gotten for two images, he had gotten 10 years, and then he had an extremely long period of supervision. I'm thinking it was a lifetime, but if it was not, it was like a 20-year period of supervision. And now he didn't serve the entire period. He was early terminated through a motion granted sentencing judge, but they imposed some pretty harsh penalties in our neighboring state of Arizona and our neighboring state of Texas.
Right. All right, ready? Put on your crazy people hat. This is from the Baxter Bulletin. Pedosexual movement must be stopped in its tracks. Recently, through various social media outlets, I have come across a few articles concerning the pedosexual movement and their lobbying for legalization and normalization of pedophilia. If you don't know what that word means, look it up. If you have a minute and choose to do your own research, you will find that the pedosexual movement is indeed a real thing with its own flag. By golly, Larry, if there's a flag, that means it's a real thing. And its own agenda. They are coming and they are bringing an army of lobbyists and lawyers with them. So far, they have been really good at keeping their efforts relatively quiet. This is complete insanity. We can't get an army of lobbyists together. I can't imagine that this pedosexual movement can muster up lobbyists and lawyers to go into their local and federal politicians and say, "Hey, we need to make this happen."
It does sound rather bizarre to me, because the last movement, if there was anything, would have been like NAMBLA, the North American Man Boy Love Association, and I haven't heard anything about them or from them for years. And I would imagine that this is somebody wishful thinking that's somewhat disconnected from reality, that would say that there's such a movement coming with a army of lobbyists and lawyers. So
I want to see this flag.
it's rather bizarre. I don't know what the Baxter Bulletin is anyway, but
Yeah, me neither.
I just don't see it happening, that such an army and such a effort is going to materialize. I don't know. There's the Flat Earth Society still out there, so
Do you know
we've
that
been
there's a
able to
guy
disprove
trying to
that
launch
for
a
how long?
rocket in his backyard to prove that the Earth is flat?
No, I haven't heard that, but he must
Oh
be a
my
member of the
God.
Flat Earth
Oh
Society.
my God. Yeah, and there's a guy going off on a completely different direction. There's a guy that will argue with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's an astrophysicist, blah blah blah, guy up in New York, and he argues with him that the Earth is flat.
Well, I think we figured out a long time ago when ships sail beyond the horizon and the mast gets smaller and smaller, and then eventually doesn't just topple off, it gets smaller. I think we figured out a long time ago that the Earth is round even before we had space travel.
There's an amazing way to figure this one out. Look at the moon from the continent of Australia. And, I'm going to use a very US-centric way to describe this. It's upside down.
I've not had the privilege of doing that, so I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it didn't. I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense when I first heard it. But yeah, supposedly, I'd have to get verification, but my understanding is the man in the moon is all upside down. Anyway, moving along. This article comes from the LA Times. California must consider earlier parole for sex offenders, judge rules. California must consider earlier parole for potentially thousands of sex offenders, even those convicted of pimping children, a state judge said Friday. The judge preliminarily ordered prison officials to rewrite part of the regulations, but Governor Jerry Brown promised voters that sex offenders would be excluded. That goes too far, the judge said in rejecting Deputy Attorney General Mariah, I guess it's Marie, no, that's Mariah. Maria Chan's argument that the ballot measure gave state officials broad discretion to exclude any class of offenders whose release might harm public safety. If the voters had intended to exclude all registered sex offenders from early parole consideration under Proposition 57, they presumably would have said so. So, can you quickly describe what a proposition is? I don't think that all states do propositions, do they?
This process they have in California where they have a closer system of pure democracy. They'll put a ballot measure out to the public, and presumably the public is smarter than the people in Sacramento, and they make decisions. And the earliest one I remember would be back in, I believe it was 78, with Proposition 13, was led by a guy named Ray Jarvis to limit taxation in California, particularly property taxes. And then there's been a slew of propositions constantly of ballot initiatives. The three strikes, you're out law, that was something approved by the voters of California. Of course, it almost bankrupted them on the prison system and caused the federal judge to limit the population of their prisons, which they're still struggling with. But that's kind of what they do in California. It's kind of a pure democracy. It would illuminate the danger of pure democracy because the people are not sufficiently informed on most issues that are far more complicated than what the average voter realizes. They believe that many people believe that the politicians make things too complicated so that they can have a job. And it's not necessarily the case. We live in a complicated world now. We're not living in the agricultural days of the founding of the Republic. So things are much more complex now, but that's what they do in California. This Proposition 57, I didn't study it in great detail, but I think it's designed to reduce prison population. And there was no exclusion by the proposition itself.
And so that's what the judge is saying, is that if the people, if the proposition had listed those as being an exclusion and then the voters voted for it, then you would have that argument. But they didn't make any sort of exclusions. So the judge is saying, hey, they didn't exclude them, so they're coming off also.
So, well, and then to clear up for those, we've got listeners in so many states where parole really varies, and we might ought to talk a little bit about parole so that we know what comparative systems. In the federal system, as an example, what we would think of as parole doesn't exist. You have you're a fixed sentence, and you serve all of it less up to 15% of good time. And then once you're released, you have a period of supervision. They refer to as supervised release. Well, in state systems, you frequently have a period where you can serve a minimum amount of your time, and you could speak to that from Georgia's perspective, but you serve a minimum amount of the time, and then you're eligible. It may be some arbitrary amount of 30%, 40% of your sentence. So they'll give you 10 years, and then you have an eligibility date that you can be released on that 10-year sentence, and that's called discretionary parole. And if you meet all the requirements, they will exercise their discretion to let you out. So what apparently they're saying in California is that we're rather than exercising discretion on each person convicted of a sex offense, we're going to decide that they have to serve the maximum amount of their sentences, and that's what the judge is concerned about. Now, in my state, we call it parole. We affix a period of statutory time. After you kill your number, you kill your number. If you get an 8-year sentence, you have to kill your number less any good time, and then you have a period of parole that's generally 2 years on most felonies. With sex offenses, it's indeterminate from 5 to 20, and a few instances, 5 to life. So that period is labeled parole, but it really isn't, because you can't earn it. You just have to serve it. So my goal is to see that illusion of actually being parole cleared up. So in California, I think they have early release for people. It's similar to what Georgia does. In Georgia, how much time do you have to serve? You're eligible to be paroled, assuming you don't have one of the seven sins that they have where you have to serve your entire time.
There's a whole grid associated with it. There's seven levels, and then, well, there's eight levels. The seven levels are a fixed number of months, you know, on a level one crime, which could be, let's just say, like you wrote some bad checks, and you might serve up to 12 months. So by the time you get through jail and get through diagnostics, you might be pretty much on your way out the door. But for pretty much all sex crimes, they affix a percentage to your time, and the minimum being 65%. I think it then does 85, and then it's either 90, you know, somewhere in there. The longest that you are supposed to do would then be 90% of your sentence short doing the maximum. I know so few people, no matter what their qualifications are, no matter how of the quote-unquote upstanding inmate that they might be, doing all the classes, never getting in trouble, blah, blah, blah. They do not send sex offenders home early.
That's my experience, even like in Arkansas and other states where they have the discretion to do that. Or they'll find a reason to keep them. They'll claim that they haven't done treatment, and then they'll have such a limited amount of in-prison treatment that the waiting list would cause the person to practically max out their sentence, because they've got 30 beds and they've got 290 on the list waiting. So, right. So it's a really system for those with sexual offenses.
And you know, just a tiny little bit further of my own personal experience.
Apparently this judge is not amused by the blanket exclusion.
Okay. I was informed that I would do the 65% of my time. So I was given a TPM, and then I completely rolled into that one and moved past it. Then they gave me another one that was about a 6 months off my time. And then I just rolled out to the maximum. So they teased me twice with a parole date or probate. Parole.
So, so that TPM would be a tentative parole eligibility month.
Yes.
I'm assuming. And that's kind of what they do in Arkansas as well. But the sexual offenses never are released in that transition eligibility. They have a PETE date,
okay,
parole eligibility or community transition eligibility, and no one ever makes that date. But apparently litigation sometimes works. In this case, the judge is not amused, but you'll certainly see the state of appeal if they haven't already.
Right. And this one is our last news article. This one is from Reason Magazine or Reason.com. 22-year-old woman facing sexual assault charges for a relationship with 18-year-old male student. The teacher, who was 21 at the time, was charged with 3 counts of second-degree assault, even though she was engaged in a consensual relationship with her purported victim. In fact, the 18-year-old parents said that their son and the teacher are in love and asked the prosecutor to drop the charges, according to WTIC-TV, which is up in Connecticut, right?
I would think so, yes.
So here we have a relationship between what would be classified as adults in the United States system of what would be called legal. I mean, you can vote when you're 18 years old. You can join the military when you're 18. So you have two adults. I guess the issue would then become that she was a teacher, so she's in some sort of authority type position, and that maybe she coerced the boy into having a relationship.
This is a bizarre story, and Narsil has actually taken an interest in it, and hopefully we're going to be issuing a press statement in the coming days, next day or two. By the time this program's heard, maybe it'll be out there. But apparently in Connecticut, they don't have the exception ends in my state when the person reaches 18. So even if the teacher directly taught the person and had that type of control, a supervisory control, it would not be unlawful. But apparently in Connecticut, as best I can tell, that doesn't apply, the fact that she's a teacher. And as near as we can tell from the criminal complaint, she didn't actually teach him, but it was at the same school. So I would say that this is probably not good behavior. behalf of Ms. Bonkle. You probably should not be engaging in romantic relationships in a place where you teach with a student that attends that school. I would encourage that if you manage the Wendy's store. I would encourage that if you manage an apartment complex. I would encourage that if you teach at university level. But then the question becomes, in my mind, is this something that warrants being against the law and a criminal prosecution that will destroy this woman's life, who's only 22 years old now? And it just seems like it's ridiculous on the surface to do that, because by all accounts, according to the police report, and that's what I'm relying on, the officer's request for the arrest warrant, he says that the student, the adult student, initiated the relationship by pursuing the teacher over the holidays of Christmas. So we've got the pursuer here, who's the student. We've got the teacher, who apparently made an unwise choice, who's potentially going to feel the wrath of the system, which in Connecticut, hopefully, if she were to be convicted, they would be no more than a probated sentence. But that's still a life-destroying thing, because this would trigger a registration obligation.
Right.
So you got a felony conviction, a registration obligation for behavior that endangers no one. Her crime was making a poor decision to engage in physical relations with someone who attended the school where she was employed, who was an adult by all measurements that we impose, to drink, to vote, to drive, to go to war, enter contracts. But he can't enter a contract to have a relationship with a person. It seems a little bit absurd. So we could go on a tangent about this case, because it's so ridiculous. But yet the statute exists, and the prosecutor will say, "I didn't make the law.
Right.
I'm just doing what I swore on the Bible that I would do, is enforce the laws of this state. And if the people don't like the law, they need to change it and let me know that this is against what they want. But my job is to enforce the law." That's what someone determined to do this would argue.
I have two things then that I want to cover. Can we push this example out to some level of gross factor? So I know that they're both adults and they're kind of sort of age appropriate for each other, 21, 20, 18, you know, whatever. So does your opinion of this change at any point if we push the teacher to 30, to 50? I don't care. Let's make her 80 years old. Does it matter?
Well, in a country where we claim that we're about individual choice and freedoms, I don't see how it possibly could if we were being intellectually honest. But intellectual honesty often goes out the window because we want to enforce our moral values. And there are those who believe that there's something disgusting about a much older person and a younger person, because the older person could not reasonably relate to the younger person. So the older person is just being a perv because they're wanting some young, fresh stuff. And that grosses people out. But in a society that claims to be open to individual freedom, I don't know how it could make a difference. But the reality is it would make a difference. The gross factor would escalate as the age difference goes up. The older the woman was, and particularly if it was reversed, if it was a man, it would get grosser a lot sooner if it was an 18-year-old female student. And as you go older, it would get gross a lot sooner. But I suspect by the time that we get much past 30, that even there would be a gross factor would kick in for this being a female and a young male.
And the second thing that I wanted to bring up, and I've lost my train of thought. Damn it.
That's what happens when you get old.
I know. Prosecutors. So even though the law is there, and Josh's podcast, The Decarceration Nation, they covered this one. The prosecutors can choose what cases they bring in, which ones they don't. So the prosecutor could just say, I don't want to push this one.
They absolutely can do that. If a prosecutor prosecuted everything that was unlawful, first of all, there would not be the resources to do it. because of the strain it would put on the system. But you'd have a whole lot of angry voters in the places where prosecutors are directly elected. So that would serve to mitigate. But the prosecutor that wants to prosecute this can hang their hat on that. And then the flip side is you get a lot of ridicule. If you'll remember the most recent president we had before the one we have in office today,
I've heard of
they chose to use prosecutorial discretion on not prosecuting people that had entered the United States, which is technically a crime.
Right.
To come in without papers is without a crime is a crime. But they chose to defer action on certain people and prioritize those who had committed subsequent crimes rather than just going after anybody who was illegal here. That policy has been reversed. Now they're prosecuting everybody that they can find, and they're deporting people that have been here successfully for years or decades. But so there is prosecutorial discretion, but sometimes we're vilified for using that discretion because it doesn't serve the agenda of the people who want to vilify, wish to vilify. But yes, I believe there is prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutor in Connecticut, since he is not elected, as best I can tell, they have an appointment system. Hopefully he will employ that discretion and not move forward with this case. But there's no evidence of that so far.
There was a situation with teens, like a whole lot of teens sharing pictures amongst each other in a school in Colorado, if I'm not mistaken. And that one just went away, as far as I know. There were like hundreds of students involved in this one. So I'm guessing that with all the pressure of the parents in that district, whatever, the DA just said, I'm going to get strung up if I try and do anything with this.
That I believe is the case that what happened there, and in Colorado they elect their district attorneys, and that was a fairly affluent community, if I remember. I don't remember if it was in Boulder or Denver suburb, but it was a place where that people's voice is heard. And I tell people that the economically advantaged, their voices are just a little bit louder.
Right.
Because first of all, they tend to be more sophisticated, know how to express themselves. They tend to be people who are in social clubs with these elected officials, civic clubs, like the Kiwanis Club or you name it. And they tend to be donors to campaigns, and they tend to carry a little bit bigger stick. Now, that's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is be. And that's one of my things that I tell people. I don't make the rules for life. I don't set up the grid that we operate under. I just tell you that this is the way it is. So I suspect that the power of the affluent put the kibosh on that prosecution because all their kids were going to be in a system that the parents didn't want to deal with. But it's unfortunate that the reality of the way things are sometimes are not that things should be.
And I didn't mean to get on, like, you know, talking about a whole different story, but just using that as the example where that one just evaporated. And as far as I know, no one was charged, or at least nothing significant, not the hundreds that were involved. And that was at the discretion of the prosecutor to not bring it, using that to then come over to this Connecticut thing where this is just silliness. And the prosecutor could say, yeah, we're going to charge her with, I don't know, like, something of a misdemeanor kind of offense. Maybe she'll still lose her teacher's certificate. Maybe she'll just be able to move to a different state, something like that, but not put her on the registry and destroy her life.
Well, hopefully that's an option. Oftentimes there's diversion programs for first-time offenders, and likelihood she is a first-time offender because of her age and the fact that she's been able to clear a background check and be a teacher.
Right.
So those programs are available, but unfortunately too often sexual offenses are excluded from those programs.
Yeah, no kidding.
So like in my state, we have we call it a conditional discharge. Some states call it deferred adjudication or probation before judgment or what number of things that, well, here it's very difficult to get when you ask the prosecutor, when you're negotiating for a plea, can we do a conditional discharge? They say, no, I'm going to oppose you all the way on that. Our office policy is we don't go along with that. But if you come in with some embezzlement, you could have stolen $100,000 from your employer, and they'll go along with a conditional discharge with some restitution and some pre-conviction supervision. But with a sexual offense, regardless of the how benign it is, very difficult to get a conditional discharge. I've seen one that I can recall where it was actually granted to my recollection. So it's rare.
All right then. So from episode 10, we had a couple comments that we were going to talk about. And Jack commented at registrymatters.co. He says, "The current whipping boy is child pornography. Most charged with this offense never made contact nor tried to make contact with a child under 18 years of age. These are voyeurs looking at online porn sites, 23 put up and stalked by our FBI, and had no intention of ever harming a child. They were compelled by their addiction to seek this porn. Given they have to register as SOs for the rest of their lives, the death penalty may be more humane. A new crop of SOs is emerging. Teens who are sexting pictures. This is sure to feed a lot of lawyers and prisons, but an absolute death knell for the lives of the offenders. The registry must be reclassified for violent offenders or completely abolished. This is double indemnity for a crime and I would think unconstitutional." Do you have any thoughts, Larry?
Well, that's a long one. We could go in several different directions on this. I'll just observe that porn is not a lifetime registry offense by federal standards. A lot of states have required that, but it doesn't require lifetime registration to be in compliance with the minimum, they're not minimal by any means, but by the minimum standards of the Adam Walsh Act, it doesn't have to be a lifetime. But many states, including my own, have done that. So in many cases, it could be a lifetime obligation. But since I'm against the registry period, my fallback position is, well, if we're going to have a registry, we should register people no longer that's required to get those precious dollars from the federal government that everybody hates so badly. But I would prefer that us don't have a public registry to begin with, and then the humiliation and unconstitutionality would not be an issue here. But clearly there is a difference about the person who is looking versus touching. But unfortunately, the system doesn't see it that way. The advocates on the victim side will tell you that this is a stepping stone, that this is a precursor to contact offense. They'll argue that, and then they'll argue, if they can't win on that, they'll argue that, well, maybe it's not. But what you can say is, in order to keep a fresh supply in the pipeline, that new victims have to be, there has to be new people victimized to create a fresh supply of porn. Nobody wants to look at stuff that's 30, 40 years old. So that it's being made all the time. So how do you respond to that when they say, if there was no demand for it, if we get these people locked up so there's no demand for it, then there won't be any new victims?
I have heard independently from tech podcasts that a significant number of the child porn websites were run by the FBI. I don't think I can think of a better example of entrapment than that.
Well, not necessarily. So what when you assert an entrapment defense, you have to overcome an obstacle providing you the opportunity to commit a crime is different than providing you the encouragement and the inducement to commit a crime. If you're predisposed to rob the bank opening their doors at 9 o'clock doesn't, that's not entrapment.
Okay.
But if the FBI agent contacts you and said, you know, I've got the inside on this institution, and at this hour of the day, we can get in undetected or whatever, and you had never contemplated robbing the bank, then you've got an entrapment defense that might actually work. But if you're out trolling the internet looking for illegal porn, and there happens to be a site that you troll upon, it would appear to the average juror that would be deciding your fate that you had the inclination, and they just merely provided you the opportunity to act out on what you're predisposed to do. And that's not entrapment, because you were looking to break the law. You're not supposed to be looking for porn.
All right.
Child porn. You can look at all the adult porn you want.
Right.
Now, I hear stories that they mix this stuff up, and it sometimes gets sent to you when you visit adult sites that you're probably far better equipped to explain it than I do. But there's ways of figuring out the sites that people go to and what they're interested in. They can target them with advertising that would lure them into these FBI sites. Now, I don't think I would fall for it, but is it possible that you're surfing The internet activity and your keywords would generate an inducement by the FBI to say, come here, I've got what you're looking for. Does it work that way?
It would work that way up to the point that I don't think that Google will let those sites get propagated out. Google has a vested interest in not, I mean, you can find anything on Google, but they do have some level of moral values as to what they will display. And as far as I know, they will not display those. As far as I know, I can't say for sure. I'm not out there looking for that stuff either. But yeah, I mean, an ad could slip through, but it's not going to say, get your child porn here.
Well, can it redirect your browser to take some place where you weren't intent? Because I've had that told me. Well, they took control of my computer, and I don't know who they is, who they're talking about. But and the next thing I know, I've got this stuff, and it's been pushed to me, and I didn't want it. Well, is that possible? In my mind, it's not, because I think I download everything I want. But I do have things pop up on my screen sometimes that I did not ask for. So I hate to discount it, since I'm not really that tech savvy to say that it couldn't have happened that way.
It's not easy to do. In the interest of everybody's security, the operating systems are pretty strong about, you know, I know that there's vulnerabilities, but what is the economic model behind them getting you to come to their child porn website? I can see why they would want to get into your system to get your banking information or credit card information. I can see the motivation there, and I could see the motivation behind them getting your bandwidth so that it looks like they are coming from a U.S. Address. I can't see the economic model of getting a bunch of browsers to log into whatever that remote site is, whether it has legal or illegal type content. There's no reason for them to do it.
So, well, maybe we need to get ourselves more enlightened on this, but I would say that the person who believes that this is wrong, I agree.
Yeah.
My personal opinion is that this being treated the same, since I don't believe anybody should be treated this way, I'm not going to vindicate
right
treating people this way, but there certainly should be some distinction between the non-contact offenders. But unfortunately, the distinction usually is they're treated more harshly. And that's the sad thing about it. The non-contact offenders think that the system looks at them as being better, and the system doesn't look at them as being better.
Yeah. And then Linda writes in response to Jack's comment, I totally agree with your comment. I agree there should be reclassification of registrants. People who view porn have different minds than those of violent offenders. No harm to anyone is intended. I know a guy who stumbled on child porn while viewing adult porn and is now branded for life. I've known him all my life and he would never hurt a fly. They throw everyone into one pot and call it quits. So unfair to many. What do you have to say to Linda?
Linda, you're whatever state you're in, it sounds like that you need to work with the advocates in that state and see if they can be some tiering system that makes these distinguishing separations between the offender categories. It's a long uphill struggle, because so many states call things violent that are not. They list the offenses and they say, well, if you've got this offense, it's a sexually violent offense. And you look at the offense and you say, well, how could a solicitation of a minor online be violent? So it's a tough one, and they throw all those people in the same category. So the public using the website believes that all these people are very bad creepers. And some of the people that are on the website didn't do much creeping at all. They did, like this teacher in Connecticut.
Right.
They did a decent exposure inadvertently, sometimes inadvertently, intentionally, sometimes inadvertently. And they got caught taking a leak in a place that was too public, and they end up with a criminal charge. That's certainly not the large number of registrants. I don't mean to imply that there's a huge number of people for indecent exposure, but there are people in the registry for that.
Right.
There are people, a lot of people in the registry for consensual sex. That was only put, the only reason the person's on the registry is if someone's of an age that the consent wasn't lawful. So we've got a lot of non-creep people on the registry. And it's sad that if we're going to have this branding machine, that we brand everybody with the same letter.
And our last comment, so quick and dirty, SW, is possibly in the Northwest, says, most of us can't vote. And I know that when we did the original recording, we went on a bit of a tirade about this one.
So, not knowing what state he's in, we can't compare a handy-dandy map, but what we can say is that that's just not the case, that there are states where felons are not disenfranchised at all. It's a very small number of states, but the majority of our states have a reenfranchisement of some type. And those states, it's automatic in some instances. In some instances, they might have to file something with the county clerk or their voter registrar. It's only a small number of states where you're totally disenfranchised for life, and you have to try to seek a pardon with restoration from the governor. So that's a misperception that all felons can't vote. In fact, the majority of felons, after they've done their time, that's the trigger on most of it. They have to have served out their sentence, including the supervised portion of it. But most people could be voting once they've paid their debt to society, as it should be.
So in your experience, with people, once they have finished their time, their paper, how many of those people then join advocacy work to try and change the laws for the next batch of people coming down the pipeline?
Experience isn't very good. By the time they finish their sentence, they're so beaten down and tired from trying to stay alive and work through all the hurdles that are put before them. They just don't find it something that they want to involve themselves in advocacy. I know people who don't vote. In my state, you can certainly vote. And in fact, I think that when we had Governor Johnson, which was back in the 90s, that's when we did the restoration, where that once they've served their time, that they can vote again. So it's been 20 plus years here, but there's a lot of people who just remain disenfranchised, and they feel defeated.
And just for sake of completeness, if you guys check the show notes, there'll be a link to this map. I think you found it from 2016 of what states, it's from October of 2016 of what states allow and don't allow people to get back into the system.
But I would encourage everyone to register to vote if they can. Your vote does count. It's very important. We have people around the world that are giving their life, risking their life to go vote, to have their fingers marked with purple ink because they walk great distances, and we have that right as a matter of birth. And we don't do it. It's too inconvenient. And I'm guilty sometimes myself. I'll go look at the line and say, gee, I should have early voted. I don't want to wait in line for an hour. Well, that's a small price to pay to have control of your destiny. So everyone take a look at the map. If you think you can't vote, you might find you can. And if you can, go register and become a participant in the system.
And these conversations continue at registrymatters.co. Larry, how can people reach us and leave comments?
Well, there's a number of ways they can reach us, Andy. They can use high tech or less high tech. They can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com or visit our website, registrymatters.co, or you can even make a phone call to us. And you'll get a polite voice that says, leave a message, and leave a cogent message that we can understand, and we will answer it on the next podcast or so. It's 747-227-4477. That's 747-227-4477.
Awesome. And we did have a listener question. A listener called in and left a voicemail, and here we go.
Hello, my name is Shante. If you get arrested in 2013, but you don't get sentenced until 2018, and in that time, the laws have changed, do you get sentenced under the 2013 law, or do you get sentenced under the new law? Thank you.
So I'm pretty sure I know the answer, and I emailed her and told her that I'm pretty sure that you would get sentenced under the 2013 stuff, but it turns out your answer is a little bit more complicated than that.
Yes, if it had been a call that I would take him personally, I would have asked her for more clarification, because the law, when she says, when you get sentenced under the law, what was unclear to me was whether she was talking about the penalty for the crime or whether she was talking about, since she's contacting Registry Matters, we would assume that she's talking about a sexual offense, and the sex offender registration obligation is a civil regulatory scheme separate from the punishment. So I would give her a twofold answer. I would say the actual penalty that they could impose for that offense was based on what was available to them at 2013 when it occurred. So if there's been any enhancements, if they've upped the seriousness of that crime, or if they've expanded the maximum penalty range. So for example, if it was fourth degree felony, they raised it to a third degree, and a third degree has twice as much potential incarceration, she would still be under the fourth degree in terms of sentencing. They could not sentence her to any more time than what was available at the time, or any more of a fine, or anything of that was that's clearly a part of the punishment. But registration may be what she was asking about. And then that opens up a whole different avenue because the registration obligations frequently change. And unless the legislature in her state specifically grandfathers the applicability and applies the new obligations to people convicted after a certain date or whose conduct occurred after a certain date, a person could find themselves with new registration obligations that are different than what were available at the time they committed the crime. So if they change registration from a maximum of 10 years to a maximum of 25 years, that could be imposed, and the court would apprise her, you have to register pursuant to SORTA, and that would be not the court penalizing, that would be merely apprising her if they were created by the new law in 2018. So lack of clarification, I have to give a convoluted answer.
So her punishment, 2013, registry stuff, whatever's current.
Potentially, unless there's been a state, if there's precedential case law that says that your registration obligations are what was available at the time, there are some states that's the case. So it would be very state specific. But it could be that she would have a greater obligation to register if they've changed in the intervening 5 years, which legislatures change registry obligations quite frequently. So, and they seldom reduce them. They're usually increasing them, trying to keep more people in the registry for a longer period of time.
All right, then. Thank you for that answer, and thank you for the voicemail. That's really awesome, and we welcome those calls to come in. All right, so on to the topic of the use and efficacy of residency, work, and presence restrictions of people on the registry. And by some research that I did, I found that it seems that Alabama was the first one to make some level of residency restrictions in 1996. And by 2006, 14 states had something to do with residency or work restrictions. And a comment that was made along the way was, while this controversial residency law has raised questions of fairness and constitutionality, it is currently legal and valid. Some critics argue that it simply plays into the fears of the public and does little to actually curb sexual assaults. So using that as the foundation, is it legal for a state to tell a resident where they can and can't live, just to like the general public, forget about the felony side of it?
Well, if we take out that side of it, it becomes more difficult. There has to be some basis for restricting a person's liberty. But in this case, they say the basis is the underlying conviction for the sexual offense. So there is some basis for it.
And a friend of mine was banished from a county, so he committed a crime, and then they said you can't live in this county anymore. And that was only for a determinate amount of time until his sentence had run out. So I think it was a total of like 5 years. And this wasn't for a sexual offense.
I was amazed. I did some case research on Georgia because banishment is unconstitutional, but apparently the Georgia Supreme Court has said that you can do it in Georgia. So they can't banish them from the entire state and deport them to another state, but they said in the interest of public safety that the and I'm paraphrasing from the decision, they said that banishment from the area where the offense occurred might be good during the person's rehabilitative period when they're in the community. So it's not intended to punish them. It's trying to protect them from themselves and from the community from the bad habits that they had. So banishment can be a good thing. So in Georgia, you can do that. But in terms of these residency restrictions, I think we would probably want to clarify that there's a number of ways that residency restrictions can come about. So the listeners need to understand that you can't just look at the state statutes of a state and see if they have them, because that cannot be nearly enough research. If a person's under any form of supervision, be federal probation or supervised release or state probation, there may be restrictions imposed by supervising authorities that are not on the state statutory scheme. A part of the state statutory scheme be the case in my state. We don't have any state statute, but the state probation parole division has its 1,000 feet rule. And then the U.S. Probation Service, I think, is very similar to what the state imposes. So although New Mexico would be on the list without restrictions, you would have those during the period of supervision that would be imposed. And then you have the other component, you have locally imposed. So counties and cities that have the ability to have their own governance that are home rule, they impose restrictions unless they're prohibited by the state statute or by a state Supreme Court ruling. You will have a plethora of hopscotch of playing hopscotch with restrictions around the state, varying from all sorts of numbers, from 2,500 feet on the high side to 1,000 or 500 feet. So you can residency restrictions can be imposed by a number of different sources. So don't just look at the state statute and say, well, they don't have them, because you just might be surprised that they do have them through some other means.
Have any states filed challenges to reverse any sort of restrictions like that?
Sure, they have. There's a favorite one that's going on in Rhode Island in federal court right now, where they expanded the exclusion zone from 300 to 1,000 feet on their level 3 offenders. They did that and retroactively applied it, which resulted in notifications for people to vacate their homes by a certain date. And
it was pretty quick, wasn't it? Like, you have 30 days to get out?
It was about 30 days, yeah. And some people had owned their house, been in these homes for years and more than a decade. So that one was stopped by a preliminary injunction. And it's awaiting trial in the federal court in Rhode Island. But there's been challenges in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois. There's challenges with various degrees of success in Kentucky. I think that was a retroactive application in Kentucky. The Kentucky Supreme Court said you can't do this retroactively and remove people from their homes. So, city of Louisville, Texas, a challenge was initiated without success in the federal court there, and the district judge denied it, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the district judge, and they basically did a banishment of about 98% of the city, or maybe even 99% of Louisville. And the attorney argued, my good friend and Narsil's good ally Richard Gladden was the attorney. He argued that effectively was a banishment, but the court said no, we have to look at this through what banishment meant in colonial times, because we look at what the framers intended to prevent from happening. And the framers did not want people banished from town. And they said, we're not banishing the offenders from Louisville. They can be in town all they want to. They just can't own a home that they're going to live in. They can't rent an apartment that they're going to live in. But otherwise, they can be in town, shop, spend their money, and pay taxes. So this doesn't qualify as what the founders and colonial people would have considered banishment. So therefore, with our limited interpretation, we're going to say that it's not a banishment. So that claim fails.
But so I don't want to diminish the Rhode Island situation with 300 moving to 1,000 feet, but 300 is significantly less than a state like Alabama, which is 2,500, if I'm not mistaken. And if you make a statute that says you can't live within 2,500 feet of a school, church, daycare, bus stop, etc., and you make that a 2,500 foot radius, then how could you can't live anywhere within that, and it's going to keep stacking out further and further to where it's a 6-hour drive for you to get to the city center, possibly even making the entire state off
that
limits,
is, that
a
is,
tiny little
that
pocket.
That is precisely the problem, that there's a case in the 11th Circuit, which is different from where the Texas case went to. The 11th Circuit is based in Atlanta and encompassed Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. They're the only three states in the circuit. And there is a case pending there on that very issue of banishment, and the challenging party is Dave McGuire, and he's represented by an attorney named McGuire, and it happens to be his brother.
Okay.
And
Oh, I remember hearing about that. Okay.
that's one of the arguments he's making, is that under his convicting state of Colorado, his conviction is so old he doesn't have to register in Colorado, but he moved out of Alabama and he wanted to be on the safe side. So he went down to the registry office and said, "I don't know if you people require this. I'm sure you don't, but I just wanted to tell you I'm here and I've got this 89 conviction out of Colorado." And they said, "Well, you just sit right where you are and we're going to verify what you're telling us." And before he left, he was registered as a sex offender. There's no place in town that he can live that meets the requirements in the urban area. I believe in Montgomery is his hometown, but he couldn't find any place, can't find any place to live. And that case is on appeal. The trial judge was not receptive. He used the same reasoning that the Fifth Circuit used, that the banishment argument did not work because he could be in Montgomery. He just couldn't have a residence there. So he's not effectively being banished. So now those of us who and our listening audience who believe that there should be a literal interpretation and we should interpret the Constitution exactly the way the framers would have used the words and understood the words, magically some of them are having a second thought, because it doesn't suit our purposes to say that there's no evolving standards of decency. Now, those who buy into the liberal mantra that there is an evolvement of civilization and things that we would not have tolerated, but we would have tolerated back in the 1780s, we wouldn't tolerate today. Some people poo-poo that as nonsense, but magically a lot of them would say, "Well, of course our standards evolve, and we would never do that today. That was colonial times." So sometimes we're a little bit intellectual dishonest about what we think, and we misunderstand that when we want these strict constructionist judges, that's what you're getting in these interpretations on these. You're getting a strict constructionist that's looking at exactly what the words would have meant in those days, and banishment did not mean anything other than clearly telling the person to leave town and never come back.
There's got to be a way to make the argument that even though, I mean, again, using like the 300 foot, that's not that far. 2,500 feet is almost a half mile. That's
a half a mile. Yeah.
Pretty freaking far. And when you do that as straight line, that's not like as you have to drive around a road and over the bridge and through the woods. That's as the crow flies. 2,500 feet is a pretty freaking far distance for, you know, you're not throwing a stone that distance. And I did a map of my area to try and see where I could try and find a place to live. And by the time, you know, being in the South, by the time I drew little bubbles around all the things that I could identify as a church, school, or daycare, there was almost no place for me to live in this area.
Well, the sad thing is that it's true, and there's no evidence that's quantifiable that this does anything to enhance public safety. I would not support it even if there was such evidence, but there isn't any evidence. In America, I thought that you were allowed to live where the economics permit you to live, and that we would not dare interfere with that. This is a free country, or so we say. Of course, that'll trigger an adverse reaction from our listener a couple of weeks ago. But we're about the individual liberty. So in this country, you pay your debt to society, you do your time in prison, you do your probation and parole, and then you should be free to live and work where you choose. I think most of our listeners would say, yes, I somewhat agree with that. So even if it did work, which there's no evidence that it does, it goes contrary to what America stands for, or at least what I was taught in school that America stands for. People can live where that they want to live. That's why we stopped segregation and people being steered to neighborhoods because they were of certain skin color. Anybody can live anywhere that the economics will permit them to live. So here we have the big bad government in a country that purports to be free about individual choice, telling people that they can't live. They can't rent an apartment or rent a trailer mobile home space, or they can't buy a home because it's located within 1,000 or 2,500 feet or some arbitrary number. That's just un-American. There's no other way to put it. It's un-American, but yet it's happening.
And just to go to the comment about the economic model, part of the reason that the whole the recession happened around 09 is that so many people were in houses that they couldn't afford, but then because they owned those houses, they couldn't easily move. So then they were saddled in that spot, and maybe there's not a job market. Maybe there's a job market 1,000 miles away. Maybe it's, five states over, but you can't leave because you've got a house payment. So that goes to support what you were just saying about you would want to live where you could work. And we're already saddled with so many, so much baggage that you're a convicted felon. Now you're also a sex offender, that it's, you would want to be in some sort of economic center, industrial center, but you might have to live, 50 miles away so that you can follow those restrictions.
And you get to live in an industrial zone where you're clustered with people who many of them really could afford to do a whole lot better. Many of them can't. I mean, I'm not saying that all people on the register are doing well, but there are people on the register that are doing well, and they can't live at a place of their choosing because of governmental intervention. And the governmental intervention is unconstitutional, particularly after they've paid their debt to society. Look at the Packingham case from the US Supreme Court. We have a lot more freedoms of what we can do in terms of restricting people's liberties when they're paying their debt. But when they've paid their debt, we have to back off if we're going to hold ourselves up to what we claim we are as Americans.
So some final points is the Pew Charitable Trust says that there are 27 states that have restrictions, and that's as of 2016. And I have some other notes that I don't really think they're relevant. In your opinion, it doesn't matter what the statistics are. And I've started to move in your direction. And as Dubling said at the conference, you can use the statistics to support the claim. But what you're going for in the first place is the unconstitutionality of having these types of restrictions up front.
I don't like to get into statistics because when you do, you invite if it saves one as an argument. And we can't disprove that it hasn't saved one or won't save one. So I like to steer clear of the statistics. Now, if they come up, you need to be prepared to rebut them. You need to be prepared to say, well, actually, when it's your turn to testify, you have to be prepared to say the statistics are not what that person just said. The recidivism is not horrendously high. But once I'm going to tell you the recidivism is in the single digits, I'm going to get on the fact that it really doesn't matter. Really doesn't matter because you can't do this in the United States of America constitutionally. You can't deprive people of the right to live where they choose to live after they've paid their debt to society, particularly at that point. Supervising authorities have a little more discretion about restricting people while they're paying their debt. But when it's done, it's supposed to be done.
So how do we fight this, Larry? So I see that there's, to me, the avenue is kind of clear that like the people in Rhode Island where they are already in a place and then they change the law and that creates harm, that creates that controversy. But if you get released from your, I mean, I'm going to, I think most, I think many people, they have the problem as soon as they're released from prison, that they have these restrictions. But even post your sentence that you have some level of restriction, you're not harmed because you haven't been harmed yet because you can't get into a place to try and live. You just have to go outside of the zone, but you don't have a claim to say, oh man, I could have lived in this really sweet house, but because you guys had these restrictions, I couldn't. Is that I don't think that argument's going to fly in front of a judge.
I think that it could fly in front of a judge. It's a tough sell, but I think it can fly that if you make the right argument. It depends on the circumstances of the person making the argument. If you've already there and they're going to arbitrarily retroactively remove you, like in Rhode Island, it's a much stronger case to make. But if you've paid your debt to society and you are being excluded from individual choice to have a relationship with whatever landlord you want that wants to have a relationship with you, I think you've got some different types of claims that can make. We've not been very creative in trying to develop these arguments. We've relied exclusively on retroactivity, which is a great one to make when it's a retroactive argument. But retroactive is not the only constitutional claim you can make. I mean, you've got certain liberty interests, and me not being a licensed attorney, I don't want to give too much legal advice, but
Sure.
there are other arguments that can be made about residency restrictions. And if we can ever get them to look at it through the next highest standard of intermediate scrutiny rather than rational basis, which if a lawmaker can articulate some rational basis for the law, then it's allowed to stand. So we've got to get beyond rational basis to intermediate scrutiny about analyzing these laws to see what type of evidence supports them. And there's no evidence that I'm aware of that supports residency restrictions accomplishing anything other than disrupting people, driving off the grid, separating them from their families. And if anything, I think there's evidence that shows that they're contrary to public safety and that they
Right.
endanger the public.
All right, I have a way to present this, and I have a feeling I'm not going to be able to communicate this very well. So there's the Commerce Clause, and that Commerce Clause was used specifically in the South after segregation had been abolished, but you still had institutions that would say, no, we can't serve those kind of people here. Their claim was that they have the right, they have states' rights to do what they want to do. The federal government came in and said, well, you're violating the Commerce Clause because those items that you're having, maybe you buy some sugar or potatoes and you buy those across state lines. And because you are segregating who can be served in your restaurant and you are participating in commerce, they shut them down through the Commerce Clause. Now, I bring that up to say that restricting where a person can live violates the Constitution from a Commerce Clause. They can't participate possibly in going to a McDonald's restaurant. They can't participate in where they live or go to school or then ultimately pay taxes. That's all commerce.
Sure it is, but do you think that the states would want to bring, say there were powers in place that wanted to end segregation and that type of discrimination? Do you sense that there's any groundswell of support from anybody to end this type of discrimination against those who have the scarlet letter? I'm not sensing that there's that groundswell of support. There is a whole different thing with what was going on. I grew up in the South in your state of Georgia, and former governor, late governor Lester Maddox, was denying black people admission to his restaurant in the 60s and early 70s. Not that long ago. I mean,
Right.
it's long ago for some people depending on their age, but really not that long ago. And he was arguing that the trespassing clause of the trespassing laws, not the clause of Georgia, permitted him to do that. But fortunately, we evolved and we decided that if your business is open to the public, that you have to serve anyone from the public who seeks to be served. And I agree with that jurisprudence, but in the intervening years, we've been actually moving backwards. We've been allowing exceptions. The most recent example of moving backwards is the religious exception, where
Right.
you can discriminate and not serve someone. And on an intellectual level, we're going off on a tangent here, but on an intellectual level, I wouldn't want to patronize someone who didn't want to serve me, didn't appreciate my business. But that's only intellectually. Suppose you've been traveling for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours by vehicle, and you get to a hotel, and all those people on the Christian side who say that it's okay to deny someone service because of your religious belief, I wonder how they would feel. Wonder how they would feel if they walked into a hotel and the hotel said, "Well, I'm of a religion where I don't rent to an unaccompanied woman.
Right.
You can just go ahead and keep traveling. Next hotel's about 90 miles up the road."
I agree with you.
I wonder how many people would believe in religious liberty that are so fond of that. So my point is that we're actually moving backwards and trying to and trying to invoke the powers of government to stop discrimination. The people we've been electing in recent decades believe the powers of government are too far and that they should be limited. And that's where I'm headed with the answer. You're wanting the powers of government to step in and stop this. It's the power of government that's done this.
Sure.
So so they're not going to step in and stop what they've encouraged to happen is all this mistreatment and discrimination for people who have the scarlet letter of being a sexual registered sex offender.
I was just using it possibly as an argument on our end, as hard as I had to bring it up to support it.
So
As always, Larry, I don't leave feeling better than when we started.
that's too bad, Andy. We spend all this time trying to inform our listeners, and you feel better. You don't feel better. Do you feel worse?
It feels like a very, very uphill climb. Very, very much so. It's against us.
That is unfortunately the way I feel. And we need all of our listeners to become involved. Go to narsil.org, become a member.
And support your state affiliates too.
Yeah, if your state has an affiliate, get involved with them. We have an affiliates tab. Go get involved.
Yep.
Don't just sit back and hope it gets better. It'll continue to get worse. Hope alone won't make this battle any easier. It requires financial resources, skill sets from people that can write and analyze. There's a whole significant amount of need that's going unmet.
Larry, you've received one of the first few issues of the Lifetimes magazine.
I have indeed. It's a great, the maiden edition, the initial, is a great magazine, very uplifting. People would be, I would encourage people to subscribe. It's trying to remember all the stories were in it. It's quite a thick magazine, and it's largely very positive about people who have done things despite having the Scarlet Label, and it will give you encouragement.
So people could visit them, Lifetimes Magazine, and that's lifetimesmagazine.org. I think it's a quarterly magazine, and you can sign up and subscribe to the magazine there.
I was thinking that we're going to do monthly, but whatever it is, I know the first edition I received, and it's quite well done.
Awesome. Larry, as always, you're just volumes, your encyclopedias worth of information on these subjects, and I appreciate your time so very much.
Thanks a lot, Andy. Look forward to next week.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye. Have a question? Send an email message to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 11. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We'd appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.